Representation in media is often boiled down to how demographics based on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and class are depicted in media texts. However, what is frequently tied to the representational analysis is how a text has failed to meet these people and sometimes places in their depiction. But why is this? What are media critics looking for in their representational breakdowns? Why do analyses frequently uncover uncomfortable truths or make reaches so far-fetched that you get a back injury? To find out why, this episode will begin a new mini-series on representation, taking a look at the frameworks, scope, and ideologies under scrutiny when we conduct representational analysis. Salutations, listener, and welcome to a new episode and to the last mini-series of the season for A Culture Made of Algorithms. I'm Omar Aileen, and this podcast takes a look at our media consumption, the culture produces, and society's left behind. So I've been watching a lot of the reactions and debates to those reactions around the centering of Miles Morales as Spider-Man in three different mediums now, and one word that keeps coming up is representation. It's a word that comes up again in textual analyses of Orange is the New Black, Captain Marvel, reality television, Black Love, Mad Men, the list goes on. But what exactly is representation? Why does it matter in media studies, and why does it keep coming up when we talk about media texts in any sort of depth? So let's look at what it actually means. Well, representation, as defined by Mary Beltran, is the visual, written, or audio depiction of something or someone. It's also a concept which covers the meaning of text and images, and the relationship these meanings have to a narrative. As such, representation is as valuable to the audience as it is to the producer, as how things and people are represented reflect both how the world within the text is constructed, but also how the producer views the world if their text is rooted in any sort of realism. And I use the word realism in regards to media creation deliberately, because as John Cowhey points out, a media text can attempt to portray media in two ways, slick and sweet like Hollywood does with lots of cuts and careful editing, or follow a second style, one which attempts to represent life as gritty through the documentary lens. There's also a third important definition to understand how representation is spoken of. That is, a discussion of representation exists at an intersection between our assumptions about the world and where they meet techniques media makers use to portray their designed world, as pointed out by Greg M. Smith. These three similar, overlapping, and yet still distinct definitions all play when discussing representation, meaning that critiques about how a media text represents people applies in everything from the purely realistic, documentary-style text to the completely fictional. This is because narratives, which are defined by Oxford Languages as an account of connected events, are story. Meaning narratives are constructed by a real person with their own biases and beliefs rooted in the real world. Take, for instance, the popular and much-beloved documentary series Planet Earth 2. When I watch the sequence where a lizard runs through a valley of snakes that want to eat it, I'm being sold a narrative that the animal kingdom is treacherous and that this lizard needs to beat all the odds in order to survive. That's as much of a story as watching a YouTuber create a fake Formula One series where they build a team from scratch in an attempt to win a world championship, or read a book about some boys surviving a plane crash on a remote island and think a pig's head is God. As such, discussions of representation can occur at several levels. It can occur at the surface level interpretation of the text. An easy parallel to make here is that you can see someone, an archetypal character, doing a bad thing, and you can say that text represented someone or their demographic badly. You can also look deeper and infer reasons. For example, seeing bin bags out on the street, rats and graffiti on a New York subway, and infer that New York is represented as a dirty place. And then you can extrapolate meaning, such as comparing the symbol of the First Order in Star Wars' latest trilogy and compare it to the symbols of the Third Reich to conclude that the First Order are a fascist group and thus should be thought of in a similar ilk to their real-life counterparts in the context of Star Wars. Which actually brings us on to how representational analysis became so important in the discussion of media texts. Because quite often, we as an audience notice how things, people, and places are being presented within a text and infer how that text portrayal is used as a way to alter our perspective of it. Take for instance that First Order example in the Star Wars sequel trilogy yet again. As someone who does not align his own politics with that of the fascist right, but is familiar with their symbols because fascist governments were a topic studied in history classes I attended, When I see a faceless horde of soldiers standing in line and looking up at a tiny pasty man shouting at them from a plinth, I'm uneasy. I know that the director has set up that shot with those images to deliberately make someone like me feel uneasy and distrustful of that character. Later on, the director would reward my feeling of unease by showing that the characters who I think are bad do things that I think are bad, such as stage a ground invasion or destroy planets with people on them. Representation, then, is the point where producer's intention meets with audience expectation. And these don't have to align. Representation can work if a producer subverts audience expectations too. It also means that representational analysis works if a producer unintentionally represents someone, something, or some place, or if the audience does not understand. Content ripe for representational analysis, then, is a part of the text as much as colour correction, even if no one can tell it's there. But then the question remains, how do producers know what symbols to put in, and how do audiences know what symbols to look for? More importantly, how do producers and audiences come to the same understanding of a symbol? Well, thankfully, the study of symbols and signs, also known as semiotics, helps to clear this up. And in the scope of representational analysis, much of semiotic discourse is based on the 1957 work Mythologies by Roland Barthes. Outlining that there are two orders of signification, semiotics is concerned with the symbols contained within a text, as well as how those symbols are used. Together, semiotics offers an insight into the producer's intention when they created the work. More importantly, though, it also gives an indication of the work's outcome, intended or otherwise. Take, for instance, the latest analysis of the 2019 horror film Midsommar by Ari Aster. In some readings, such as the one conducted by Wisecrack, for example, make the case that the Midsommar Festival is misrepresented by being inaccurate. Its featuring of sex rituals and human sacrifices, whilst also accurately portraying rural Swedish life by featuring mural paintings, having a group eat herring, and a placement of fire wreaths on a festival goer's heads, is not a realistic representation. Instead, in this interpretation, the symbols read to make an exaggerated representation of the Midsommar Festival, and the story is a reflection of Aster's imagination of it, or at least an imagined version that Aster thinks embellishes the story well. However, in a different reading of the text, Kay and Skittles point out that the anti-immigrant banners, ethnically homogenous cult, and language tied to white nationalism paint the text as being an interpretation of how fascist cults recruit vulnerable people and trick masses into joining extremist groups. In this translation of the text, Midsommar is not an exaggerated description of the Swedish festival. Instead, Midsommar represents how fascist groups conscript vulnerable people based on Aster's understanding of how fascist groups and their recruitment tactics work. And thus, that is the horror of the movie. This use of symbols, though, can be problematic. For example, in the case study I just used, the symbols in each of the two readings aren't contradictory. If anything, the two readings can almost exist simultaneously. And in the case of Key and Skittles, who released their reading in response to the Wisecrack one, it does. So in that case, using an exaggerated and embellished representation of Sweden and its festival was a way in which the fascist symbols were easier to notice. Regardless, though, this naturally creates a dilemma around what might be the true reading of a text might be. However, the answer to that dilemma does not negate critique about the symbols themselves. This is because readings, as long as they use the content found within the text, can be accurate. As such, when reading the text, what becomes clearer is that the reader is expected to have a pre-existing cultural understanding about the symbol being shown. Translate this finding to audiences, and you will see that audiences will consume a text, filtering it through their own cultural, political, historical, societal, and idealistic filters. Sometimes, these filters are shared, or at least overlap with the producers and other audiences. In turn, what is argued when using symbols in a debate about a text representation is if the audience as the reader and the producer as the creator have the same understanding of the symbol, and thus, question, is the symbol being translated accurately? This is because a symbol consists of two parts, the signifier and signified. Together, they produce a sign. Now, a signifier is the word or action we use to describe an object, and a signified is the object or subject itself. As such, we can see that cultures, context, the language being spoken, and a depth of knowledge of that language all affect how you talk about the signified. My favourite of many, many examples of this. It's how semiotics can break down the sign that is a dog. To me, an English speaker who doesn't know all that much about dogs, all dogs to me are just the one word. Dog. To an English speaker who is an avid dog lover, each dog breed might be a better way of referring to the dog in particular. To someone who speaks a gendered language, the word for dog may change depending on the speaker's gender, and again based on their level of understanding about dogs. And then we have sign language, an entirely different language that once again changes between regions and level of articulation between users. As such, if you as the reader cannot or do not know what you're looking at, then the sign does not exist to you in the same way it exists to someone else, just like it does with everyday language. Therefore, this rule is not unique to semiotic analysis either, rooting the practice closer to our everyday behaviour, which is full of deliberately coded symbols. Take for instance this following sign. It's a white circle with a thick black diagonal line going from bottom left to top right. If you don't have a driving license, or if you're not learning to get one, then this sign might seem somewhat peculiar. Yet, if you do have a driving license, particularly if you're here in the UK, that sign is coded to tell you that the road you're operating on is operating at the national speed limit, along with its restrictions. This deliberate coding is found in media text such as film and television, and hides meanings for the scene it's operating in. Take, for instance, the idea of the pathetic fallacy. For those of you who had to endure secondary school English literature, you might know that the pathetic fallacy is the attribution of human feelings and responses to innate things or animals, especially in art and literature. That's defined by Oxford Languages. Perhaps it's best known as a scene where the rain falls to indicate a character's impending sadness. This is yet again a form of semiotic analysis. So back to the idea of representation then. What semiotic analysis uncovers then is not just a symbol and how it was used, but the ideology underpinning the specific use of that symbol. And we can interpret possible ideologies in the use of previous examples. So in the case of using the white disc and black line through it, we know that using existing psychology reports that road signs are designed to quickly trigger a response in road users and are faster than relying on word recognition and are designed to be subliminal, we can, as such, infer that speed and ease of recognition are at the base ideology at play. In the case of the prophetic fallacy, the ideology is to humanize the contextual environment so that the interpretation is seemingly obvious in meaning. As such, when we then reapply this interpretation of signs consistently to the topic of representation, we can argue that media texts use symbols to deliberately convey meanings about people, places, and things in a way that reflects the producer's belief system quickly to the audience. This is why representational analysis gets media producers in hot water on a regular occasion, also later on in life when texts are revisited by new audiences with a different cultural lens and understanding. But why do producers get away with it in the first place? Why are films such as Avatar heralded as works of environmentalist art in 2009, but called imperialist propaganda pieces in 2019? Well, as Dan Lougheed writes in Media Studies, Theories and Approaches, common values, beliefs and ideas limit the range of acceptable meanings and representations that an ideology can accommodate. As such, when looking at the ideology of a text and by extension its producer, what is commonly revealed is a mutual belief system shared by the producer and its original audience. After all, the producer should have a target audience and know how to reach them. So by making a text that reaches that target audience, the text should contain content that appeals to them. And we can do this by looking back at the earlier reading of Midsommar by Key and Skittle. If they can read that the text is an anti-fascist film, and then the ideology of the film is anti-fascist, and as Key and Skittle frequently create anti-fascist content, their acceptance of Midsommar as an anti-fascist work aligns with Lougheed's assertion that for a text to be accepted, the audience should have the same values as the one the producer put into the text. However, with representational analysis, critical discourse happens when its secondary and legacy audiences, i.e. unintended audiences, get a viewing of the text. These audiences might be parents or older siblings talking about a children's film, in the case of a secondary audience, or people who watch a film in 2030 when it came out in 2020 in the case of a legacy audience. This is how critical conclusions around representational analysis are frequently rebuffed, with claims that a text was of its time, particularly in relation to how a text discriminates against people with protected characteristics. But that's also how representational analysis uncovers a third framework at play, Hegemony. Now, hegemony is a topic that is covered extensively within discourse around political economies, so its definition here stays the same, even if the execution is used to find a different conclusion. Now, concerned with the dynamics of power at play within a society, looking for a hegemonic power structure within a text is commonly overlooked by an audience, because the audience is a part of that power structure. Which is why products of their time rebuttals are often surface level, ill-informed, and inadequate remarks in representational discourse. Let's look at the 1966 Golden Globe nominee Othello as a quick case study. Criticised today for its use of blackface by lead actor Laurence Olivier, counter-critics are happy to point out that blackface was an acceptable technique at the time of its release, as seen by the positive reviews of the movie and its Golden Globe nominations. But then the question remains, acceptable to who? It was 1965 when the film was released, 1966 when it was eligible for an award. And as Strauss Burp notes in his 2006 book, Black Like You, Blackface, Whiteface, Insult and Imitation in American Popular Culture, blackface had already been identified as offensive and an expression of white supremacy by black Americans for years preceding the civil rights era, and this folds nicely back into the topic of hegemony. Because now that we know the representation of black people in the time was offensive, using that representation gives a light onto who chose to incorporate that form of representation and who had the power to change it or even care. And if hegemony gives an insight to the ideology present in the text and the ideology of the producer who has to agree with the audience, it also gives an indication as to who the target audience of the film was. And if that agreeable audience is also a part of the panel for the Golden Globes, what you are seeing is not just a time capsule for which ideology was present, targeted, and propagated, but a quick look into which ideology or ideologies were present in powerful people at the time also. So, okay. Representational analysis uses symbols and interpretations of these symbols to highlight which ideologies and power structures exist within the text and a society which share the text. But why do we as human beings care? Well, there's two schools of thought when it comes to how media impacts us as individuals, and thus it goes on to impact our culture. The first school of thought is the one we looked at last week within consumer power. It argues that people choose the media and thus the way it impacts them is minimal. If anything, people have an impact on their media, and if we look at an idea that an ideology within a text has to be shared by an audience in order to be accepted, there is some credibility to the claim. The second school of thought is that the media we consume has an impact on us. And whilst comments such as video games cause violence are in this vein and have gone on to be debunked, we do know that political advertising, a form of media text, impacts elections, and elections are an expression of a societal culture. I mean, just look at the 2016 European membership referendum here in the UK and the US presidential elections of the same year and the scandal of Cambridge Analytica to see how targeted advertising can change even the highest levels of political office. We also care about representation in media texts because we know that media texts carry ideologies and can help us shape new ones. We know that because 1915's Birth of a Nation is partly responsible for the second rise of the Ku Klux Klan and for the amount of racially motivated violence that spiked in cities where the film was shown against black people. In fact, representation and how well or ill it is used is often directly associated with how the general population views a particular topic, people, place, and even time. And this isn't just limited to fictional texts either, but factual ones too. It's sometimes spoken of that it wasn't the event of 9/11 or even the image of the towers falling that caused an uptick in US Army recruits or reports of Islamophobia. It was a narrative that America and Americans were under attack by unknown Muslims from somewhere in the Middle East. But in fictional texts, representation can still impact our perception of people, places, and things. Take a minute to think about the previous episode on hyperreality and simulated realities. In that episode, we talked about Baudrillard and his theory of the hyperreal, that we have consumed so much about places like New York that we would be disappointed if we turned up one day and didn't experience the yellow cab or an aggressive conversation. And if that version of hyperreality is to be believed, then how much more disappointed might we be when we meet a black man in our reality and they aren't the hyperreal gangster that so many have been cast in as fictional texts? Or even imagine meeting a gay man for the first time and they aren't feminine. Double down. What if you meet a hyper-feminine black gay gangster? In believing to some degree that the media we consume affects us even remotely, we have to accept that representation in the media also impacts the people around us. This can apply to how they are perceived by the rest of us, but also how they perceive themselves in a society where people are expecting them to be like something. So if, in one instance, we show people inaccurately in a negative light, that's one thing. But to also show them as outsiders to a wider society, that's another. And to also show that they don't or didn't have the power to change that negative, inaccurate depiction, that can only compound the issue. But representation goes two ways. If poor representations can negatively impact someone's sense of self as well as their perceptions by other people, then it can also be used to build esteem for people which have positive media archetypes. By extension of its mirror image, positive representations can also attribute to people, places, and groups positive reactions by wider society and societies that may not have been completely earned. So this is why people care about media representation. Because whilst some may see the media as a fickle way to be entertained and a shallow medium which does nothing for the betterment of human civilization, others recognize that media is a tool someone can use for societal change. They recognize that the media and its effects are tangible, traceable, and meaningful. So what are the media consumptive practices in this episode, the cultures they produce, and the society left behind? Well, our consumptive practice is to consume media containing codes that we understand, as they reveal a worldview to us that we already agree with. However, our cultural behavior around texts generally are contested, with the level of analysis going into these texts differing depending on if we are the target audience and a part of the power structure which allows this text to be produced. This differs from previous societies where media consumption was only created for audiences who were a part of the hegemonic power. So for this week's poll, the questions will be, does the media you consume feature representations that reflect your worldview? Do you think representation matters in media texts? Are people like you represented accurately in media texts? Should producers make greater efforts to represent groups of people accurately? To take part in this poll, I encourage you to follow me on Twitter as @ACMOAPod. The poll will be there in the pinned tweet promoting this very episode and will run for as long as this episode is the latest episode. Alternatively, you can reach out to me on Instagram and Vero as @OmarAileen. Or if you feel like you want to get at me in a more professional capacity, you can email me to aculturemadeofalgorithms@gmail.com. Next week, we're going to continue this conversation by looking at why and how institutions, from charities to the police, to military and government, care about representation, and what impact such approaches are having on us as individuals. But until then, though, make sure to keep consuming, think about the culture you're a part of, and who you're leaving behind. Stay safe. Thank you.